While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the Radio News Analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and welcome to On the Reading News Analysis right here on Eagle FM. I'm your host, Nafa Happy Juju, and today is Friday, the 27th of March, 2026. Now, this afternoon, once again, turn our focus to key developments shaping Namibia's national conversation, from economic trends and governance to innovation, business, and youth empowerment. Now, these are not just headlines, they are the forces influencing policy direction, economic opportunities, and the everyday realities of people across the country. Now, On the Reading News Analysis is more than a news update. It is a platform for in-depth analysis and understanding. Right here, we go beyond simply reporting events. We unpack the why and how behind the news, examine the data and the decisions driving change, and explore what it all means for Namibia's future. Now, over the next 1 hour and 30 minutes, we'll break down major stories, engage with key perspectives, and connect the dots between policy, economies, and the society. Whether it's a shift in the economy, a new government initiative, or emerging opportunities for young people, our goal is to provide clarity and insight that empowers you as the listener. Now, in a fast-moving and information-rich world, understanding context is just as important as knowing the facts. That's why On the Reader is committed to delivering credible information, balanced analysis, and meaningful conversations that help you stay informed, aware, and prepared. So wherever you are tuning in from this afternoon, across Namibia's towns, cities, and communities, we do appreciate you for joining us. Now, this right here is On the Reading News Analysis on Eagle FM, not just reporting the news, but helping you understand it. Now, let's get right into today's discussions. Prime Minister Eliane Ngarairi officially launched Namibia's National Work Integrated Learning, also known as WIL policy, 2025 to 2030, yesterday at Namibia's Institute of Public Administration and Management, also known as NIPAM, marking a significant step towards strengthening the country's education to employment pipeline. Now, the Prime Minister spoke at the event yesterday alongside, was introduced by Deputy Minister of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture, that is Minister Dino Balotti, as well as at the engagement was Executive Director and Executive Director of Education, as well as the Director of Vocational Education and Training, Mr. Dalia Muya. Now, the newly launched policy aims to bridge the long-standing gap between academic learning and practical workplace experience by embedding structured work-integrated learning opportunities within Namibia's education and training system. The Ministry of Education, Innovation, Youth, Sports, Arts and Culture highlighted that the policy will formalize partnerships between education institutions and industry players, creating pathways for internships, apprenticeships, and cooperative education programs. It is expected to improve graduate employability, enhance productivity, and support Namibia's broader economic development goals, with officials stressing that the policy aligns with national development frameworks and responds to calls from both the private sector and public institutions for a more skills-oriented education system. Now, by integrating theory with practice, the Work Integrated Learning Framework is designed to produce a workforce that is adaptable, innovative, and ready to meet the demands of a rapidly evolving economy. Let's now take a listen to students that spoke at the event. One such student is Cecilia Ambunda, and thereafter we'll still come and listen to one of the recipients of the apprenticeship of the work integrated learning. For now, let's take a listen to Cecilia Ambunda.
It is with profound honor and indeed a deep sense of awareness of this very moment in our national journey that I rise to address you today. We gather here not merely to launch a policy, but to affirm a national commitment, one that speaks directly to the aspirations of young Namibians, to the evolving demands of our economy, and to the enduring question that every student, trainee, and student graduate or TVET graduate who dares to dream, the question that is, am I ready? Am I employable? Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Cecilia Mbuda, not a graduate like Johnny Konja, but a final year law student at the University of Namibia, UNAM of Namibia. And today, I stand before you at that very gap of that question. Like many of my peers, I've spent years of my journey immersed in the statutes, case law, theory, carefully constructing an academic foundation. Yet, as essential as that foundation is, I've also come to realize that it is only when knowledge meets practice that true professional identity begins to take place, to take shape. And that for me is the promise of work-integrated learning. Work-integrated learning answers a gap that has long existed between our institutions of higher learning and the realities of the workplace. A gap where many graduates, though qualified, find themselves uninitiated in the rhythms, expectations, and the demands of a professional life. A gap that industries, in turn, experience when seeking individuals who are not only knowledgeable, but adaptable, responsive, and work-ready. It is within this space that internships become not only optional, but necessary. Allow me then to take it closer to home. During my third year and through my university's work integrated learning program, I had the distinct privilege of interning at Metcalf Pierkes Attorneys, a prominent law firm here in Windhoek, for a period of 1 month. A brief encounter, some might argue. And yet, within that short period of time, I encountered the lessons that no lecture hall could have ever taught me. I saw the law not as it exists on paper, but as it unfolds in the lives of people. I observed the weight and the responsibility carried by legal practitioners, the precision required in every word, the discipline demanded in every task, and the humanity that underlies every decision. I came to the humbling realization that understanding the law is one thing, but practicing it ethically, effectively, and compassionately is quite another. There were moments of uncertainty, moments where I questioned whether I was adequately prepared, but it is in those moments, those uncomfortable, stretching, and defining moments, that I learned where growth took root. I now not only have the theoretical understanding of how particulars of claims are drafted, but I also have the practical knowledge of how to draft them, because I was doing it on the job. And I believe the same goes for every student, every trainee, and every graduate who has had the privilege of doing work-integrated learning. Internships also teach us humility. There is nothing like spending years mastering theory, only to be asked on your first day of work to make a cup of coffee, which, by the way, was not my case, or to organize the files. And further, I realized that even that requires a system, it requires a skill, and it requires attention to detail. It is in this small task that I began to understand the larger picture and the importance of work-integrated learning. While my experience was enriching, it also reminded me of the broader reality that many students are not afforded the same opportunity. Access to internships remains uneven. Some students navigate a landscape limited to scarce placements and insufficient institutional linkage. Graduates, in turn, often encounter the paradox of modern employment. They will require 5 years experience for this post. The need for experience in order to gain experience. And across the workforce, this translates into gaps in preparedness, in productivity, and ultimately, by extension, in national development. And I believe, Right Honorable Prime Minister and Honorable Coach, that it is for this reason that work-integrated learning must be understood not as an isolated intervention, but as a collective responsibility. Our universities, our technical vocational centers must continue to evolve, not only as centers of knowledge, but as active facilitators of opportunity. The private sector and professional bodies must recognize the immense value of opening their spaces to young developing talent, and not as an act of charity, but as a strategic investment in the future of this, of their professions. It is also at this particular point that I'd like to commend the ministry, Honorable Coach, for its leadership in advancing this important policy, and to further applaud the government, Right Honorable Prime Minister, for its commitment to strengthening the link between education and the world of work. The approval of the National Work Integrated Learning Policy by Cabinet marks a significant milestone in our country's efforts to ensure that education remains responsive to the needs of both the students, the trainees, and our economy. This decision demonstrates a clear recognition that practical experience must form an integral part of learning, and that preparing young people for meaningful participation in the labor market requires collaboration between government, educational institutions, and the industry. Through this policy, government has taken a bold and commendable step towards creating a more inclusive, skill-oriented education system that empowers students to transition from lecture halls, from workshops into workplaces, and with confidence and competence. And I must say this also, this lifts a huge worry off my shoulders, knowing that I won't be the last to benefit from work-integrated learning, and that it will not just be limited to a few of us. It will not just be the Cecilia Mbudas or the John Ikonjas who get these opportunities. But because of this policy, my nephew Tangeni may have the chance too, and my friend Jikiti will have a chance as well. And this is only possible because we have a government that listens and that prioritizes the growing needs of its people and its economy for the greater good. Equally of importance are student-led structures. Student representative councils remain a voice of the student body, articulating the needs, advocating for inclusion, and ensuring accountability. Movements such as the Namibia National Students Organization, NANSO, continue to fulfill a historic mandate to table, to amplify, and to champion the issues that matter most to the students, including this very one, equitable access to internships and learning opportunities. Ladies and gentlemen, when these forces, the government, academia, industry, and student leadership move in unison, we begin to see not just programs, but progress. And so may it echo that as we mark the launch of this National Work Integrated Learning Policy, we are in essence also reaffirming a shared vision, a Namibia where education does not end at graduation or does not end in the lecture halls or the workshop, but transitions seamlessly into meaningful participation in the world of work. A Namibia where potential is not left dormant, but is cultivated, guided, and realized. But while we call these stakeholders to action and we celebrate the launch of this policy, it is also imperative that we shape it in implementation to ensure that our students, our trainees, our graduates are not exploited. Through policy shifts that speak to set minimum remuneration, maximum working hours, and other guidelines protecting both parties, this can be achieved. In closing, I would like to repeat the words of our late founding father, Dr. Sam Shafishuna Nujoma, words that have echoed across our generations and which remain profoundly relevant to the journey we seek to advance. I quote, "The best way in which we can address social and economic inequalities in our country is by ensuring that all our people, especially youth, are provided with quality education," unquote. And I'll add this to say, the quality education must be accompanied by access. Access to opportunities such as this, where our students, trainees, and graduates can be groomed and prepared for the work world. May we continue to move in this direction, strengthened by not only by what we know, but by what we are given the opportunity to do. Because truly, there is learning in doing.
Mm-hmm. And that was a student, not yet a graduate, like we had already, that she's a lawyer still currently studying, but has gone through the work integrated learning. But now let's take a listen to John Ikonjer, who has gone through the work integrated learning or apprentice and is not a fully graduated working person now. But nonetheless, let's take a listen to John Ikonjer.
My name is John Ikonjer, and it's an honor to stand before you here today to share my journey as a graduate who well benefited from the Work Integrated Program. Well, my story is going to be short. I came from Okahanja, specifically from Fayfran Camp, at a place many know as a dusty, but I think it's quite a humble place that's full of hardworking people trying to build better futures for themselves and their families. Growing up there, many Namibians, just like many young Namibians, we dream big. Sometimes, obviously, you follow or you try not to follow the timeline, or rather life does not follow the timeline that you imagined. When I was in school, unfortunately, I failed grade 12. Well, that's what the Ministry of Education says, but I don't think so. At that moment, I remember thinking of my dream, studying media and filmmaking, studying journalism and media studies, and eventually working in media would be a delayed dream. For many young people, failing grade 12 feel like the end of the road. It can make you feel or question your abilities, even your future. But one thing I've learned in life is that failure is not the end of the story. Sometimes it is simply the beginning of a different path. Eventually, I enrolled into Tryphon College, where I began studying journalism and media studies. And then in 2018, during my first year, I was given the opportunity that would completely change my life. Through the Work Integrated Learning Program, I was placed at the Namibian Broadcasting Corporation, working at NBC TV as an apprentice who started in the newsroom as a junior reporter, eventually growing to become a TV producer and now a news anchor. At that time, I was just a student who was trying to understand how the media industry works. But the Work Integrated Learning Program does exactly something much more incredible than that. Something more important, in fact. It takes students beyond the classroom and places them inside the real working place where theory meets practice. For me, this meant stepping into a newsroom for the first time. I saw how stories are produced, how journalists investigate stories, issues that affect the real Namibian people, how television programs are created, and most importantly, how the media serves the public. From 2018 until 2020, I worked under the apprenticeship program at the NBC, and those years really shaped my life. I was learning from professionals, observing how the newsroom actually operates, understanding the responsibility that came with informing a nation. And slowly I began understanding that something deeper was about me being placed in this very position. Media is not just about cameras, microphones, or being on television. It's about service. Through journalism and broadcasting, we are given an opportunity, or rather a responsibility, to serve the Namibian people. We inform citizens about what is happening in the country. We tell stories of communities. We highlight challenges that people face. And also, sometimes we help bring attention to the issues that can improve the lives of Namibians. That is the power of this profession. And that is also the power of the Work Integrated Learning Program. Because without the Work Integrated Learning Program, many students like myself or graduates like myself would finish their studies without ever experiencing the real environment of their profession. And I think, and I honestly believe, and we all know that will bridges that gap. The opportunity that has been created. Opportunity for students to learn, opportunity for institutions to mentor young talent, an opportunity for Namibia to build skilled professionals who are ready to contribute to the country. For me, that opportunity changed, like I mentioned earlier. What started as a student's apprenticeship eventually turned into a career. And today I serve as a permanent television producer and news anchor at the Namibian Broadcasting Corporation. Thank you. And every time I step into the studio, I remember that the journey began with a program designed to give a student a chance. So to the students who are in the room, I don't see many, but I'm sure we are all students of life, so. So to the students, I want to leave this message. Do not underestimate the opportunity that programs like the Work Integrated Learning provide. When you step into, when you enter a workplace through this very program that we are launching today, do not see yourself as just a student competing for a requirement or for experience. See it as an audition for the future. Be curious, ask questions, learn from those around you. Show dedication and discipline, because you never know, the place where you start as a trainee may one day become the place where you build your career. If a young man from Fayfran camp in Okahanja who once failed grade 12 can stand here today as a national broadcaster, that means that possibility exists for every young person in this country. And that's why programs like the Work Integrated Learning programs are so important. They do not just train students. They open doors, create opportunities, and build the future of this beautiful land of the brave. Thank you so much for your attention.
Quite interesting contributions right there by John Ikonja, which are actually truthful contributions, especially in the aspect of saying work integrated learning gives students the necessary skills that they need, and they give them first-hand practical experience that they that is required of them. It gives them also an idea of where to sort of begin when they get into the work, when they eventually get employed. So they give them the understanding of a more practical knowledge as opposed to just a theoretical knowledge that they were used to three, 4 years at university. Now, let's take a listen to Prime Minister Leon Goraere, who emphasized that work integrated learning policy is a strategic response to youth unemployment and skills mismatched in the labor market. Now, he noted that many graduates possess theoretical knowledge, but often lack the hands-on experience required by employers. And also, he brings in the practical example of saying a student graduates on Friday and on or perhaps on Saturday, and on Monday they're being asked, we need you to have 3 years experience. And where are they actually going to have to take to get those 3 years experience? And it's time that Namibia really starts discussing those things, this tension, perhaps starts having this important discussions and bringing about tangible results that really speak to the core of what is being felt by young people on the ground now. Now that you say that the policy seeks to ensure that students across vocational institutions, universities and training centers gain meaningful exposure to real working environments before completing their studies. Let's take a listen to Prime Minister Elian Grare.
President Netumbo Nandi-Ndaitwah has walked the talk and has given an amount of 257 million for this financial year that is ending towards Youth Development Fund. And in the next financial year becomes 500 million. Our challenge is how to access that, how to tell the students to access this. That appears to be our challenge. And last week or 2 weeks ago, we met those who have been given this work to ensure that young people access these funds. We met Agribank, we met DBN and EIF. The challenge was that they too, when they were given this work, as we launched it, in Omaheke last year, because I was given a document like this. Prime Minister, this is what you must read in order to launch. So I looked at it, and there was some way that says the youth must give collateral. So I look at the document, I put it aside, and I went to read the opposite. These loans are collateral free. And that is what I announced. I phoned my boss and said, this is what I did. I couldn't do the other one. And she said, yeah, that's a good thing. Because yesterday I was climbing a drum as youth leader, saying youth empowerment, knowing that the youth have challenges of accessing collateral things. Now here I am, because maybe air condition officers, I'm talking a different language. I could not, and I must not, and we must not. Therefore, we told the colleagues that are now doing this, fund managers or whatever they are called, we told them, don't be creative in creating stumbling blocks for young people to access these funds. That is the conversation we had, a harsh conversation, but one which we believe we must have. So therefore, young people who are listening to this, when you are sent out in all 121 constituencies and 14 regions of our country, there is learning in traveling. Where you are sent, whether it is Hobabis, whether it is Besebas, Neifontein, go there to experience and change what you will find there. And then when you have found that there is a niche here in a Homba or Sesfontein, and you formulate your idea of how to do that, if others could start universities from a kitchen, you can start greater things just by walking even in Okangwati. And it is doable. I look at work integrated learning, that it must be an idea that must be planted in our young people. There is a place in Zambezi, I think it's called Kasivi. It's a school. During COVID, we were saying, why are our people using the bush instead of toilets? And we asked, how come now that we have quotas, we have many VTCs, and yet we cannot do the most basic? Zambezi VTC went to construct a modern toilet facility at Kasivi. And when I visited Chinchimane last year, that toilet still stands. Which means the capacity exists within us only if we work together to make things happen. We have asked Enana VTC to go to Ongudi. I hope there's progress. Thank you. Let's give them a round of applause. So these young people are the ones we have said, they are the ones that must go to Ongudi, they are the ones that must go to Mukuvi, they are the ones that must go to Kasivi and other places. Why? To bring dignity to our people. And you, we must give you a round of applause as VTC, as the MESAC. You must not get tired to give and plant hope in the young people. They are riding a bicycle of life, and they must balance the gravity from time to time. They will stumble, but it's not the end of it. Let's believe in them practically. Let's not say, graduate and go and create jobs with what? We must say now, go and create jobs, because this is the seed capital. Yes. And that is the youth development fund. And we can talk about it as Namibians with in good English, in good Afrikaans, in all other languages. But let's talk the language where we are able to empower a young person, even if the dream, we don't understand it. And therefore, work integrated learning for me is that we have a policy we are launching today, and we rely on the partnership. But we must lead by example for our students and graduates. Leading by example also means being deliberate and thinking out of the box. Implement such learning, integrated learning that we are saying, with common sense. For example, we place students in urban as we do in rural. And there is nothing wrong to place one of that student at Ombara, at a traditional leader. They can do some work there, and I can assure you the learning or the experience they will derive from having been attached to that area, it will be priceless. And it therefore requires us, ourselves, to do it deliberately. The reason I changed the speech in Omaheke, because it will be disingenuous of us. And I think all of us agree. Sometimes we go to graduations, we see it. The kids graduate on Saturday. On Monday, they are coming to our work. You see, I know that maybe we are programmed to say things, but you were there. You were there at the graduation. But Monday, do you have 5 years' experience? I mean, how do I manufacture 5 years from Saturday? There was only Sunday. Now Monday, you are asking me, where would I get that from? Es ni montlek ni. Khlat ni danki. Do you get that? So now you understand why I'm saying let's have faculty of common sense. You see? So therefore, I really want to appeal to the private sector and those who are in the space of job creation, that continue what you are doing. It's a good thing that you are doing in terms of providing those various categorization of work integrated learning. But so too, ourselves, you see, I don't think you lose anything by being patient with that child that is riding this bicycle trying to learn. I don't think you lose anything. You can correct me. The Bible says, if your child is asking for a bread, it's unlikely that you'll take a stone to give. I don't know which verse, but Denges Evers in the Bible. So therefore, if we are serious about building a peaceful and prosperous Namibia, we must create clearer pathways from education to employment. The outcomes we seek have already been made clear, and the Deputy Minister has spoken to that. Let this be, therefore, let it be the moment where we transform aspirations into action. Let this be the moment where education and industry work hand in hand. Let this be the moment when our young people see opportunities being built. And I want to appeal to all of you here and those that are watching from through Bluetooth or artificial intelligence. Of all the things that we must pray to have in Namibia, unity must be our common denominator. When these young people graduate and they come to you asking and knocking for an opportunity, do not look at them in the lenses of a tribe or a race. Don't say, because they speak not the language I speak, I therefore forfeit this opportunity, I'll give it to the one that speaks my language. Don't say, because this one is from my region, and therefore I will favor this one over that one. Don't say, it's because this one is poor, I rather give it to the one that is rich, because through richness I might have connections so that I can rise. Don't say, ah, wie sê ek moet net vir hulle gee. Is ook vir ons. Is ons tyd om te eet. It's our time to eat. In essence, what you are doing is maybe closing off the door of the future millionaire of Namibia. You might be closing off the door of the future Mark Zuckerberg of Namibia. The future of Bill Gates, the future of Francis Ndongo, Dangote. Maybe that's the future, a future of Netumbo Nandindaeto. To the girl child and to the boy child, your dreams matter. Never give up. For the girl child, we know that not too long ago there was a fund created by DBN that will assist the girl child. But there is no girl child without a boy child. There is no future in one and not the other. So therefore, the boy child, your dreams equally matter. Work-integrated learning, therefore, in my view, is a path, is a journey that we must work together. Let's hold hands together. Let's sing the song of unity, the loudest. If there is a mountain that is higher in Namibia, let's climb it and sing that song louder. Let's walk in what appears to be the valleys of Namibia, but let's do so holding hands. And above all, let's take a hand of a child that we do not know what future awaits them. Imagine for those who believe in Jesus, of which Namibia we are many, imagine at the manger people would have said, whose child is this? And they would have left him to be. Imagine those of you that are here, such as our young lady that spoke here. Because there is none of us who made it to be who we are, and we did it just on our own. It's not possible. It is not a mistake when we say it takes a village to raise a child. All of us were supported one way or the other to be who we are. Whether to pound mahangu, to cook washikwira, or to make mutete, or everything. All these things, we had support network of somebody who was there for us. So therefore, be there for somebody. From here, go and plant the seed for somebody. From here, do it for another, regardless of who they are. Don't judge them by any other standard except the competency that you see and the hope and dream that you have in that person. And that is the seed of hope that we must plant. We may not be there to see the fruit of it. Those who sacrificed during the war of independence or war of resistance, they did not foresee this day, but we are here today. Let's also do it for those that are coming. So the government is happy to see the strides MAISAC is making. The government is happy that in 2026, a young person has been able to enroll in institutions of higher learning without having to pay registration and tuition. These are small but significant and impactful steps. So therefore, my friends, with these remarks, I want to thank those who have made this possible, including GIZ, But I also want to make sure that ourselves, this is...
Easter's cheaper with extra low prices at Furman Brock. Get 2 kg Tastic rice for $36.99. A 2 litre Coca-Cola for only $21.99. 2 kg Sunlight hand or auto washing powder for $54.99. And 9 Twin Saver 2-ply toilet rolls for only $69.99. Hop on over to vurmanbrock.com to see more Easter bargains at WB. We care.
Phew, what a day. Finally on my way home. And hey, the taxi's empty. So much room. Oh no, why is this big guy getting in and sitting on top of me? No, not the Mimo with the big bag too. Now I'm squeezed.
Sometimes in life, you just get squeezed. But luckily, with Express Credit's term loans, you can get up to 32,000 Namibian dollars to help ease your financial squeeze in under 15 minutes.
Ah, now that's a relief.
Visit expresscredit.com.na. Express Credit, money when you need it.
To make sure that ourselves, this is ours. Whether there are others who assist us, but we must assist each other more. We must invest in this work integrated learning ourselves more, so that when the others are finished or tired, this dream does not end because some people have pulled out of it. It must be ours, and we must walk with pride that it is ours.
So, and now, since today is Friday, let's call up our lucky winner for the 500 ShopRite gift voucher. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, how are you, man?
Well, thank you. You are live on air now. This is Happy calling you from Eagle FM on the Reader News Analysis.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. First of all, who am I speaking to?
I'm speaking to Alma.
Alma.
Yes.
Alma, where are you? In the land of the brain?
Grootfontein.
Oh, Grootfontein. Alma?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm calling to inform you that you are this Friday's lucky winner of the 500 ShopRite You Saved gift voucher.
Oh my God, wow.
Yeah.
I'm so excited, I don't even know what to say. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome.
Thank
it comes,
you
it comes
so
in
much.
at the right time, right? Month end when you need to do your shopping.
Definitely. Actually, I even want to go do some shopping for Easter.
Ah, imagine. So some extra cash in your pocket.
Exactly. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Amar, my team will call you up and let you know how and when you can pick up your gift voucher.
Okay, ma'am. Thank you once again.
Sure. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that was Alma from Grootfontein, and she is this Friday's lucky winner of the ShopRite You Saved gift voucher. Now, remember, you can also be part of this wonderful good news. You can be our next lucky winner. All you have to do is continue to participate, and you just never know. For now, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, and I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukurile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshiwana. Onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doili nawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi tayo loka. Opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa. Ninge kwata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM onora etatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ile konderewa nora etatu natu bali o etatu watatu omafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Welcome back, and in some breaking stories, a Minister of Industry, Mines and Energy, Modestus Amutse, this afternoon said that the nation's fuel supply is stable and that the only variable that the government is monitoring is the global fuel prices. The Namibian government is providing strategic guidance, and I quote, and is confirming that the country is a net importer a net importer 1.1 billion liters of fuel, with 70% diesel and 30% petrol, with 100 million of both products being consumed monthly in the country. Amutse stated in the briefing on the fears of fuel shortages to be experienced. Now, the minister confirmed that there is a 1 to 2 months worth of petrol and diesel. Amutse also noted that only the price of the products can are influenced because of the war in the Middle East. He added that the supply of the petroleum products cannot be influenced. He said the stock remains adequate and reassured the nation against any panic buying as a result of the wars in the world. Now, the country is observing the key international platform of pricing for fuels. The government will reduce fuel levies within the fuel prices by 50%. This is to ensure that no price inflationary pressure is to be transmitted to the consumer public. Amutse added, he said government will spend to the tune of 500 million Namibian dollars in the coming period for the next month. On top of that, fuel prices are increasing, with petrol set to rise by 2.50 Namibian dollars, or 2 Namibian dollars and 50 cents per liter, and both diesel products by 4 Namibian dollars per liter, effective the 1st of April 2026. That is according to the Minister of Industry, Mines and Energy, Modestus Amutse. Now, with this being said, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. We'll be back shortly.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye. The eye.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I am planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite opoye ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evito da njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi nawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka okone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ili nawa ninge kwata fanona Monica ko Eagle FM onora esatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile konderewa nora hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom.
Welcome back, and now for some economic indicators before we get to news beyond the borders of Namibia. $1 is equals to 17.08 Namibian dollars, and £1 sterling is equals to 22 Namibian dollars and 70 cents. €1 is equals to 19 Namibian dollars point 72 cents. $1 is equals to 11.77 Namibian dollars. $1 still is equals to 4 Namibian dollars and 65 cents. One Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 24 cents. And now let's get into news beyond the borders of Namibia. Interestingly, South Africa's government has urged calmness as among its citizens and consumers as fuel prices remain stable, even though they have increased drastically.
It's not looking good for motorists as a massive fuel price hike is set to kick in next month. There have been incidents of panic buying and scattered diesel shortages being reported despite government assurances that supply remains stable. Motorists are expected to flood filling stations in the coming days, with many concerned about a prolonged war in the Middle East.
I think that in terms of the fuel increase, everything boils down back to what we can afford and what we can't afford. You know, I mean, everything is going up except our salaries. So, I mean, how are households supposed to live if there's a pensioner in the house with one income earner or just a pensioner? You know, so everything is affected. And that creates more health conditions because of the stress levels. How are you going to manage to provide food? How are you going to travel to work? So it has a ripple effect.
The way things are going at the moment, the current Middle East wars and so forth, I suppose we don't have a choice. I'm just hoping and praying that South Africa's got enough reserves to last us at least a couple of months. I don't believe that's the case. I hope the 1 week reserves and the fact that we've been selling our reserves at one stage, I hope that's not true. But let's see what happens.
It's not looking good. Most of us are going to have to fill up before it goes up. But the feeling that we're getting is A lot of the petrol stations are telling us they don't have petrol. So I normally fill up in the Northcliffe area. I've had to drive this side to come get the normal petrol that I usually pour. So how that's going to affect our pockets? I know the food prices are going to shoot up if they have not shot up already.
I'm not prepared. I don't feel well, but I'm spending less on my petrol. But to other people, it's going to be a lot for them, especially food is going to go up. Everything is going to go up because of the petrol. Yes, affect kakhulu, especially those people who are using ama taxis. It takes pretty food. The prices are going up. It's going to affect us a lot, a lot.
Filling up ahead of the petrol price increase. I think it's inevitable. I mean, it's out of the control of South Africa. We import fuel. If the global price goes up, we're a victim of that. There's not much we can do. So sadly, we will pay the price, both in the short term and the long term.
The last time there was a major energy shock was in 2022 during the Russia-Ukraine war. But economists warn that the current situation could be even more severe.
This is coming at a month that a lot of people will be traveling. We're going to Easter. We know a lot of people travel from their own provinces, from Gauteng, from other big provinces or economic hubs to their respective ones. So when that is happening, one can say that traveling will be very expensive, especially on the diesel. And seeing the diesel price going up, we see that it becomes a concern because a lot of production, especially in the agricultural sector, and also the movement of what has been produced, it requires diesel. So it is going to be take a strain a lot on the consumers.
Meanwhile, calls are growing for government to provide fuel levy relief as the record April fuel price hike looms. SABC News, Johannesburg.
Meanwhile, President Cyril Ramaphosa led a cabinet meeting in Free State in South Africa.
Let's take you now to the Free State, where we find SABC News reporter Makgala Masiteng, who's in Bloemfontein and joins us live from there. Afternoon, Makgala. We know that President Cyril Ramaphosa led a cabinet meeting in the Free State, really just scrutinizing the funding model of municipalities like the troubled Free State, saying that it needs to be restored so that investors can be attracted. Talk to us about what came out of that.
Yes, and in his opening remarks, as you have indicated already, he did mention that the full potential of this province needs to be unleashed, and noting that it is uniquely positioned in the center of the country and that the province should use that to its advantage. But he did commend the province for what the strides that it has made in the agricultural sector, but also how it has been able to position itself, of course, for the renewable energy investment, as we have seen throughout the province, especially in the Lijolobuzo district, that there are many of those solar plants construction, big projects that are under construction in that region. However, what was important was him talking about the performance of various municipalities, that it's about time that the focus now comes to the implementation of all the policies, rules and regulations, because he said that the problem is not that there's a lack of policies or lack of regulations, but the issue is the lack of implementation, saying that the yardstick that government is actually judged upon is on the implementation, because if there are no services, people are not satisfied. The trust between government and the people is broken, and that's when you will see people taking out to the streets. Of course, he highlighted some of the issues that many municipalities are marked by poor performance, poor governance, financial mismanagement, and other issues that need to be addressed, actually also appealing to the province and also government ministers to say that this is a platform for all of them to come together to resolve all of those issues, because if there are challenges that are locally in local government, provincial government and the national government should be able to intervene to ensure that the trust between government and people is restored and that service delivery is able to be delivered to the people. But most importantly, talking about economic growth in all of those municipalities, that is significant in attracting investors to come and invest in all of these provinces that have already been suffering when it comes to the generation of revenue, which he also mentioned that many of these municipalities, the revenue that is being collected, the equitable share that has been given to these municipalities is channeled to salaries instead of delivering services. That is one of the issues that he says must be addressed. So at the moment, they are locked inside, of course, discussing some of those issues and finding a way to resolve them, and how national government can intervene where, of course, the province need an extra muscle to be able to deliver. But we have seen, even with the visit of the president yesterday to one of the projects at the location, where the MEC of Human Settlement in the province, Saki Mukwena, as well as the Premier of the Free State, Makhwini Letsoamatai, already highlighted some of the challenges that the province is facing, given the fact that it's still behind when it comes to budget eradication, but also allocation of houses, as well as sanitation in some of the areas. That those are some of the issues that they are still battling with, but they are confident. Even during her opening remarks, the Premier of the Free State did indicate that the province has had many challenges given its history as well, but they are confident that they are on the right track in resolving some of those issues. And the president has appealed, of course, to the province to not shy away from talking about all the challenges where they need help, so that there can be some kind of intervention. In fact, while I'm just talking about the intervention, the president also highlighted that many municipalities are still under administration throughout the country, noting that in the province, 7 of those municipalities are under administration. This has really been highlighted as one of the problem areas in the province, that many of these municipalities are forever under administration, but there seems to be no improvement. Talking about some of those municipalities that have been, of course, under administration for years, but they don't seem to come out of those conditions. So we'll continue, of course, to monitor. What I understand is that for now, they will be locked inside discussing, and later on, we will be able to get just a brief of what has happened inside during the discussions inside, as I have indicated that various ministers are present from different departments and MECs, and of course even the representation coming from 5 district municipalities here in the province. As the president did highlight, that what is at the core of either service delivery or economic growth is the local government, because that is where everything is happening. So when the money is channeled there, it should be used accordingly to address service delivery, but also to boost economic growth in those municipalities. That is how municipalities will then be able to attract investors. Making an example about Ethiopia, that it has now been turned into an economic hub, and that is because they were able to change the situation around, and with that, investors are now coming or flocking in numbers, and that is what the province and the country as a whole is supposed to be doing, making sure that the conditions on the ground are improved, the environment is attended to, service delivery is delivered to the people, so that when conditions are better, investors will be able to come and invest in those municipalities. So those are some of the issues that they are discussing as we speak.
Thank you very much. The SABC News reporter Makhala Masitein giving us a sense of talks that are behind locked doors in the Free State, where President Cyril Ramaphosa is really just tackling some of the ongoing political and service delivery issues. And
in other news, China grants South Africa duty-free access for exports.
South Africa scrambles to diversify markets and accelerate export growth. China is emerging as a sure bet. A landmark framework agreement on economic partnership for shared development signed between the two countries gives South African exports duty-free access to the vast Chinese market.
It is also an answer to unilateralism and protectionism. That show South Africa and China hand in hand to open wider both their market to each other so that they can enhance our bilateral relations.
South Africa accounts for the largest share of nearly $300 billion in trade between China and the African continent. That figure is set to climb as the agreement opens greater access for key exports, including minerals, agricultural goods, and higher value processed products.
We've given them an initial list of 100 products, and those include manufactured products. But we've now said, now that we have this agreement, we can do a more comprehensive early harvest program that would enable manufactured goods to go into the Chinese market, and therefore you're able to add value to the quality of trade that you have with China.
This agreement will open wider, of course, China's market to high quality, South African products like rooibos tea, wine, beef, seekers, and nuts. But also it will benefit Chinese customers because they will buy these products with lower prices.
The deal goes beyond market access to China. Pretoria is positioning for a potential investment boost from its largest trade partner. South Africa is fast growing as an attractive market for Chinese automakers, gaining ground on traditional players.
There's a significant increase, in fact, of imports that we get from China, but there's also been appetite to invest in the country. More recently, Chery has made a deal with Nissan. We've also had commitment from BAIC, that was the initial company that invested in the country, to transition from semi-knockdown to complete knockdown, meaning actual manufacturing in the countries.
Beijing's zero-tariff move does not stop with South Africa. It extends to 53 African nations, broadening the scope of China's trade engagement across the continent.
It is also a time of great opportunity for our continent and indeed for our country as well. Global economic uncertainties, climate risks and shifting trade patterns underscore the need for building economic resilience and capability, diversifying both our export basket and our exporter base is in the end key to our economic growth strategy.
Africa and China have crossed the threshold into a new trade era. For many debt-burdened African nations still grappling with the threat of reciprocal tariffs from the United States, the agreement represents a huge win. Producers across the continent now have easier access to one of the world's largest consumer markets, with the potential to boost incomes, industrialization, and economic growth at home. Julie Sharis, CGTN, Cape Town.
And we now cross over to Julie Shai. She's joining us live from Cape Town. She's covering Vice President Hang Jong's visit. Julie, so what is the significance of this visit by Vice President Hang Jong to South Africa at this moment?
Hi, Beatrice. I'm here at the Parliament in Cape Town, and the meeting is happening just behind us. South African Deputy President Paul Mutashile has just welcomed China's Vice President Han Zhang. We've seen that the two delegations, when they arrived today, they've had a joint statement, and we are expected to have that actually officially for us because, as you know, the media was in when they welcomed us. They then all protocols observed and then we had to come out. But the visit really comes at the back of a series of high-level engagements between the two countries. And China's President Xi Jinping conducted the state visit to South Africa in 2023 when the country hosted the BRICS summit. So last year, Premier Li Qian attended the G20, and now the vice president is here. So Han Zeng's currently in a meeting with Paul Mattachili, and the two will also chair the ninth plenary session of the China-South Africa Binational Commission. And that is actually a flagship mechanism that has been in place since the early 2000s. And it is really to deepen and create a cooperation between the two countries. I do apologize if there's some noise behind us. There is a march that's happening from some students. Clearly, they do know that the deputy president is here in parliament. But continuing with your question, Beatrice, that this collaboration with South Africa and China has expanded for years. And let's not forget that this year, the 2026 is the people-to-people's exchange year. And so very much this visit will focus on science and technology, but more importantly on trade and investment, as we saw in my package before. And that is what is really deepening this relationship, Beatrice.
So, Julie, how does this engagement position relations between China and South Africa, who are both members of BRICS?
So, Beatrice, remember that China remains South Africa's largest trading partner and that this has a significant importance for the country because it shares a lot of the Chinese investments. China's also 15-year plan is also very much something that South Africa could benefit from, and we believe that that might also be in the discussions here in South Africa. But it is very clear that China really wants to push the support between the two countries, and this relationship will actually just strengthen a lot more what South Africa and China have achieved for the past three decades. And this is a very high-level diplomatic engagement, and that it also deepens the BRICS partnership when South Africa obviously joined Brazil and Russia and India and China. And so all this investment has very much been in play for the past few years. And this is where we are thinking these conversations will possibly go into. And there's also a meeting tomorrow. And so trade between the two nations has been, I think, an important figure we need to mention, more than $50 billion, and that South African produce really does now have a very important part to play with the zero tariffs that South Africa and China will be putting into practice now this year.
Meanwhile, Trade Minister's IWTO, that is World Trade Organization's reforms.
Evening. So the WTO Director General had some very interesting things to say in her opening statement. She said that the old world order and the multilateral rule system is gone. And in her words, we must look to the future. But from the perspective of African economies, what does that future of trade within the WTO look like?
Yes, good evening. Thank you very much for having me. This is a very interesting WTO ministerial conference. If my recollection serves me right, this is the second ministerial being held on African soil. If I recall well, the first one was in Kenya in 2015. As far as the history of the WTO is concerned and the role of African countries, the focus of African countries has always been, and it's subject to evolution, obviously, with the times, but ensuring that African countries play a central role in global trade, graduating their economies from what was a historically resource-based African economies to economies that are able to participate meaningfully in global trade in advanced goods and services. But that transition has always been facilitated with the support of the developing countries, of the developed countries. Now, with all the geopolitical tensions that we're witnessing, it has become more challenging for African countries to advance a solid position with an understanding or expectation of getting support from the traditional trading partners, from the EU, from the US and the UK and the like. And what that necessitates now, or what that has necessitated, is more innovativeness on the part of African countries to come up with solutions for themselves. And that includes diversifying their trade partners, but still using the WTO system as we've known it. Now, what is encouraging about the WTO system, in as much as it is facing a lot of challenges, unprecedented, is that there is baseline predictability insofar as, you know, setting the MFN standards and the like, to know that goods and services move across boundaries on predictable terms. Now, what is going to be key for many African economies is whether or not issues concerning agriculture, trade, agricultural trade, cotton, issues of fisheries and the like are going to make central attention in this ministerial conference that is being held in Cameroon.
Right. So, talks, I just want to jump in on something that you've raised there, because talks on WTO reform have stalled in the past, because decisions, of course, in the WTO tend to be made by consensus rather than majority vote. What would it take to get decisions made by much smaller groups of countries, decisions made by majority, rather than having everyone in the room agree?
And if you look at the fundamental agreements setting up the WTO, you have the multilateral agreements that must be agreed to by all parties, and then you have the plurilateral agreements, which countries that are willing participate in such agreements, and they do so on reciprocal terms. Insofar as the multilateral agreements are concerned, which is the foundation of the system, there is no scope to maneuver without the consensus of all the parties. But when it comes to plurilateral agreements, there's a scope to maneuver there. And I think that this is the space that African countries should begin to focus on. Because in as much as African countries may want to complain that they are on the receiving end of the global tensions that we see now, a counter argument would be that African countries have also been free riders in certain aspects, insofar as the platform, the original platform of the negotiations in the WTO, African countries were not meaningful role players. But it is only now in recent years that with the development that we've experienced, you now have African countries only now being ready to participate meaningfully, but still lagging far behind. So the critical question is, how do you maneuver the space within those bilateral agreements? Because if you are going to put attention on the multilateral agreements, which we all know that the developed countries are far apart in terms of the issues of their priorities. If you look at the priorities of the EU, for example, and the priorities of the US, they are far apart. And that tells you that we should not expect any meaningful progress, for example, on issues such as the WTO dispute settlement system. We shouldn't expect any meaningful progress on issues such as trade and environment, which remain contentious because the EU and the US, for example, they are far apart on such issues. But you could see meaningful progress on bilateral basis, on plurilateral basis as well.
Indeed. We'll leave it there for the time being. Thank you very much for your input tonight, Sizwe, an international trade specialist joining us live on the program.
Meanwhile, Africa leads in mobile money, but cash remains king. Now, Africa dominates global mobile money, processing roughly 70% of global transactions value, with over 1 billion accounts and $1 trillion in annual transactions. Yet, much of this still ends up as cash withdrawals at ATMs. A South African fintech is tackling this last mile challenge in underbanked communities. Let's take a listen.
Bang Monyamane started eJuice when he hit a roadblock trying to withdraw a mobile money transfer. While cash sends and e-wallets have changed the way funds are received, allowing payments to mobile phones instead of bank accounts, getting your hands on the hard cash is still a challenge.
I was broke and desperate, and I convinced my brother to send me a cash send because I didn't have money to actually go to the ATM, which was 5 kilometers away. So I convinced Ben, the local taxi handler, to give me a ride. And then when I get there, we found out that both nearby ATMs had just been bombed the night before. So I had no money. to pay for the ride.
The eJuice platform in its pilot phase is providing an alternative solution, allowing users to move funds into a digital wallet that can be used to transact.
Say you're a mother right now, you want to send your child to buy bread at a local merchant. What you do is that you just tap on the app, you process everything, you give your child the code. They just go there with the code and tap it with the merchant, then the merchant verifies and they give the child the bread.
The app, which can be accessed in South Africa's 11 official languages, helps small businesses link to the platform, track and monitor transactions, but also reduces the risk of using cash.
I think digital is going, that's where we are going now. And even with the crime rate, you see, the crime rate is very high. So just having electronic money is better, it's much better than having cash in you. I don't long, no longer go into the bank to do that. So I'm just transferring the money to the eJuice.
Mobile money apps are becoming increasingly popular in townships and in rural areas, largely because banking infrastructure is not always available.
The main driver of that is about 90% of Africa has mobile coverage now. I mean, I don't want to guess the number, but when you look at bank penetration in the high or in the more rural areas, I think bank density is incredibly low. This is where the fintechs come in and they can actually play a much more important role here. So whether it's access to credit scoring, for people that have maybe never had an actual account in the past, I think you start to create some access through that. But just general financial inclusion.
Mobile money is a powerful driver of financial inclusion and economic growth in poorer areas. But across sub-Saharan Africa, cash remains the most popular medium of exchange. Turning the last mile digital may take some time and will require a steady overhaul of the financial system. Sumitra Nadu, CGTN, Johannesburg.
And in other news, the Pentagon has denied a report that the U.S. is considering sending 10,000 troops to the Middle East.
The Pentagon has declined to comment on media reports it's considering sending up to 10,000 additional troops to the Middle East. It would mark a significant boost to U.S. military presence in the region amid growing speculation that Washington may be preparing a ground operation in Iran. Meanwhile, Iran Revolutionary Guards say the Strait of Hormuz is closed and anyone transiting through the area will face harsh measures. These developments come as President Trump says he'll postpone plans to start destroying Iranian energy plants by another 10 days after claiming talks with Tehran were going very well. His self-imposed deadline, which he has already delayed once, is now the 6th of April. Iran hasn't publicly reacted to President Trump's decision, but Tehran earlier said it was waiting for Washington to respond to its conditions for a ceasefire. After the U.S. had sent Iran a 15-point U.S. proposal to end the war, Iran outlined 5 of its own proposals and insists it has a natural and legal right to sovereignty over the Strait of Hormuz, a transit route responsible for a fifth of the world's oil. Our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, had this analysis on the extra U.S. troops being sent to the Middle East.
They've got 2 Marine Expeditionary Units on their way, 2,200 Marines on both, plus attack aircraft, helicopters. I mean, they're quite small, but quite formidable. One of them is nearly there. The other one is coming from California. It's going to take a bit longer. There are supposedly about 3,000 paratroopers from the 82nd Airborne on the way. They are lightly armed. Their job is basically to go in and hold something until the guys with the heavy equipment can come. And now they're talking, and there's this report in the Wall Street Journal of 10,000 more troops on their way. I have to say, this doesn't mean that they're tooling up for an invasion of Iran. When they invaded Iraq in 2003. I think the number was 160,000, and that is a country a quarter of the size of Iran. So they're not going to be doing that. But going for an island, maybe not Karg Island, the oil export terminal, but some of the other islands near the entrance to the Gulf. Karg Island is up near the top. And there's some islands around the entrance to the Gulf, which may be a base for trying to control who goes in and who goes out. But, you know, one thing that has been quite clear in all of this in the last month is that while the Americans appear to be making things up as they go along sometimes, President Trump, because he does oscillate wildly in the things that he says, the Iranians appear to have a plan. So they will know that the Americans are thinking about this, because, look, we're talking about it. It's no secret. And so they will have a plan to try and make it as painful as possible for the Americans if they do that. For example, launching drones that can be launched from hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away from those islands. And they could make it difficult for the Americans at the very least.
That was our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, speaking to my colleague, Kasia Madeira there. Well, the German foreign minister has said the US and Iran have had indirect talks. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, gave his analysis, saying there is a major gap between what each country is willing to accept.
Let's stick what we know for sure, which is that there are messages and proposals being passed both ways, from Washington to Tehran and back again. But there is a major gap between what the two sides are prepared to accept. So I find it very hard to believe that the, quote, talks are going well, because the Iranian demands are unacceptable to the Americans and indeed here to the Gulf states. And America's demands are unacceptable to Iran, which is feeling very defiant. Look, there's a good reason why President Trump has paused for another 10 days his threat to attack the power plants, the energy plants of Iran, because Iran made it very clear that if that happened, it was going to hit back at power plants on this side of the Gulf. And that would be catastrophic for the countries of this region. You're talking about desalination plants that provide the drinking water, hospitals, you know, schools, all the rest of it. Now, they've already taken a lot of hits from Iran, but this could be so much worse if those power plants were hit. So there have been messages from the Gulf states to the US. Please think really carefully before you do this, because we are going to get hit in return.
We are, of course, hearing US media reports that the US is sending more troops to the region. How prepared do you think both sides are to negotiate and try and resolve this conflict quickly?
That both sides are absolutely prepared to negotiate, but on their terms. And I think there is a parallel here with the Russia-Ukraine war, where you had both sides saying, absolutely, we want to end the war, but on our terms. And those terms, I think, are still far apart. There's been a miscalculation, without question. If you talk to anybody who has a sober analysis of this war, they will tell you, including military people who don't want to be quoted, that there was an overestimation by the White House and Central Command as to how quickly Iran was going to crumble. They thought that with this shock and awe of this overwhelming military superiority that the US and Israel undoubtedly have over Iran, that the regime would collapse or capitulate. And it's done neither. And every day that it survives, despite losing so many key people, despite losing so much weaponry, despite so many hits, it's still standing, and that's making it very defiant. And if you talk to anybody, any military commander, they will say, look, it's not about how many sites you hit, how many missiles you destroy, how many commanders you assassinate. It's about the net effect that you achieve. And Gulf Arab states, and I'm speaking to you here from Qatar, Gulf Arab states, they look at where we were a month ago. Their ships carrying their oil and gas were able to pass freely through the Strait of Hormuz without being threatened by Iran. There were no drones and missiles flying across the Gulf at them, and life was sweet. Somehow, it's all gone very wrong.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Please do stay tuned for the Ankonana Dengi program brought to you by Loise Shimi. And thereafter, the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut from 1630, the Business Economic segment with David Chambe from 1800 Hours. Don't forget to tune in for our weekend podcast, weekend education shows. mine specifically, on Saturday from 1900 hours to 2100 hours live lessons. From Indafa, happy Juju, it's goodbye.